Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from the University of Nebraska at Omaha on Noon Forum. On today's program, we'll hear a talk by Dennis Ross, the William Davidson Distinguished Fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, and a Distinguished Professor of Diplomacy at Georgetown University's Walsh School of Foreign Service. He is the author of Doomed to Succeed, The U.S.-Israel Relationship from Truman to Obama, which will also be the topic of his presentation. His remarks were given as the annual Ruth and Phil Sokoloff Lecture. This program, co-sponsored by the Natan and Hannah Schwalb Center for Israel and Jewish Studies at the University of Nebraska at Omaha, was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, April 5th, 2016, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the University of Nebraska at Omaha, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Gary Javitch, speaking on behalf of the Sokoloff family. The speaker will be introduced by Alan Potash, Chief Executive Officer of the Jewish Federation of Omaha.
A wave of anti-Semitism has swept Europe, and it has also reached our college campuses. Within the last month, campus groups mounted an anti-Israel apartheid week program disguised as human rights campaigns. In actuality, there are a series of public events designed to spread misinformation and hatred about Israel. And here I'm borrowing words from honestreporting.com, which is a website that I encourage you to check out for accurate information about Israel in the news. Apartheid, according to Webster's Dictionary, is racial segregation. Israel is a country of over 8 million people and has 1.7 million Arab citizens, full citizens with full equal rights, including 17 members of their parliament that include Druze, Bedouin, and Sunni Muslims. There's an Israeli Arab Supreme Court justice and a mayor, and Arab actors and models, soldiers and singers, with enough doctors and lawyers to make a Jewish mother proud. Israel's the only democracy in the Middle East with equal rights for all religions, genders, and sexual orientations. Israel is the exact opposite of everything that the word apartheid actually means. So to all the students present, I encourage you, as Phil would have, to keep reading, keep studying. And to all of you, again, thank you for joining us. Again, welcome.
Thank you, Gary. I'm Alan Potash, CEO for the Jewish Federation of Omaha. I want to welcome you all tonight to a wonderful program. We are fortunate tonight to have one of the most influential experts on foreign affairs and Mideast policy. I've relied on Ambassador Ross for his understanding and analysis of the Middle East for over 25 years. A recent example of this was the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, also known as the Iran deal. He and his colleagues at the Washington Institute were out in front dissecting the pros and cons of the Iran nuclear agreement, which in my opinion remains an issue. And even the Washington Post reported yesterday that the U.S. Navy confiscated a cache of weapons that it believes was being transported from Iran to the Houthi rebels in Yemen. Navy officials said this is at least the third time in 2 months that such a shipment was stopped. Maybe the ambassador will answer some questions about Iran for us this evening. I'm sure you'd love to. Ambassador Ross is one of the few, if not only, the only individual to have had a seat at the table on foreign affairs with every president since the Carter administration. He is respected by presidents of both political parties as well as heads of state from around the world. He'll be speaking this evening about his latest book, Doomed to Succeed, The U.S.'s Relationship from Truman to Obama, which will be available for him to sign and for you to purchase afterwards. This is one of the most comprehensive examinations of each presidency's dealings with Israel. Reading this book is a firsthand view of the events, policies, and personalities behind the history. For me, it often read like a mystery or adventure novel, finishing one presidency and guessing how the next one would turn out. Ambassador Ross has served as a special assistant to President Obama, a highly skilled diplomat. He was the U.S. point man on the peace process in both the first Bush administration and the Clinton administration. He was instrumental in assisting Israelis and Palestinians to reach the 1995 interim agreement, brokered the 1997 Hebron Accord, and facilitated the 1994 Israel-Jordan peace treaty. He has worked extensively to bring Israel and Syria together. Ambassador Ross worked closely with Secretaries of State James Baker, Warren Christopher, Madam Albright. He is equally well-versed in the former Soviet Union, arms control, and the greater Middle East. We're very fortunate to have him with us this evening. He will speak for a while and will be available to answer questions, and then you'll be all be welcomed into the book signing and reception afterwards. It's my pleasure to welcome to Omaha Ambassador Ross.
Thank you. Okay, so I like to walk and talk partly because I teach, and when I teach, I walk and talk, and it helps me think. And partly because a year ago I got a Fitbit, and and I'm not quite at 10,000 steps today. And if I don't do my 10,000 steps, you know, I feel really bereft. So you'll bear with me. At some point, I'm going to get the buzz in my wrist, and I'll jump a little bit. Then you'll know I've hit my target. I'm glad to be here. This is actually my third time in Omaha, and I am going to talk about the book. The book is called Doomed to Succeed, the U.S.-Israeli Relationship from Truman to Obama. It is true I was a political appointee for President Reagan, for the first President Bush, Bush 41, for Bill Clinton, and for Barack Obama. And it's also true that I'm often asked, how is it possible that I actually could have been a political appointee for Republican presidents and Democratic presidents alike? I mean, how did I get along? How did I manage? How did I cope? How did I deal? And my answer has been, well, I spent the last 30 years working with Arabs and Israelis. I mean, how hard could it be, right? Turns out a little harder than one might imagine, but so let me. I am going to talk about the book, but let me start off by raising a question for you. You're going to find I engage you tonight because I like engaging the audience. I like to pose questions. All the questions I pose, I can answer. We'll see how I do with your questions, but I'm going to start with a broad question for you, and you'll see how I link it into the presentation. Where we are, I mean, look at the Middle East today. It is, to use a diplomatic term for it, it's a mess. And if you were to describe what is President Obama's most important objective in the Middle East in the remaining time he has in office, what do you think it would be? His most important objective in the remaining time he has in office, what would it be? His most important objective, I think, in the remaining time that he has in office is to have some symbolic success and some practical success against ISIS. Now, the key to that is, in the end, is having Sunnis join us. We need the Sunni tribes. We need Sunni governments. Because at the end of the day, only the Sunnis can discredit ISIS. Ultimately, only the Sunnis can be the forces that really will replace them. First of all, force them out and then replace them. If you don't have Sunnis to replace them in governance after they're gone, then we will see son of ISIS. ISIS itself is the successor to al-Qaeda in Iraq. So if you don't have Sunnis to replace them, you're going to see the next incarnation of ISIS. Now, the reason we have a problem is that we're not attracting the Sunnis into this fight in any meaningful way. And the reason we're not is because, first, their priority is different. Their preoccupation is Iran, it's not ISIS. Secondly, they don't think that we are acting to protect Sunnis. And they need to see some sign that we're prepared to protect Sunnis. And that's unlikely in the remaining year of the Obama administration. What you see at this point is that there is one set of priorities that we have and a very different set of priorities that the Sunnis have. And yet we need the Sunnis if we're going to do what President Obama's original objective was. When he announced that we were going to take on ISIS, what did he say? He said our objective was to degrade and ultimately destroy ISIS. Well, we can't discredit ISIS, only the Sunnis can. And ultimately, we really can't destroy them unless they're discredited and they're defeated. So it's not going to happen during President Obama's time. But I raise this for a reason. One of the things you're going to see as I go through and describe issues related to the book and what I wrote about and what is revealed is that from Truman's time until today, we have not understood the priorities of Arab leaders. Now, we don't have to accept their priorities, but we will not have effective policies in the Middle East, at least until we understand what those are. And then you shape policies accordingly. So I want to get into the book, but here again I want to provide a little bit of a context, and I'm going to pose a question. Because as I said, I like to pose questions. Rabbi, actually it's a Jewish tradition to pose questions, right? So it's I'm in good company here, right? All right, so how many people here know that since October there's been almost daily acts of terror in Israel? Everybody, right? Since October, you've had what some refer to as a knifing intifada. The term intifada is used, intifada means uprising, because there's no easy way to explain this. There were two intifadas before. This one doesn't look anything like the intifadas we saw before. Why? Because the first intifada and the second intifada had organization, structure, leadership, affiliation. What you're seeing since October is none of that. You're seeing attacks that are being carried out, inspired, incited, largely by social media. Those who are carrying out the attacks are primarily between the ages of 15 and 25. There are a few that have been older. There have been some who are as young as 11. And we can get in the Q&A, we can get into a discussion of why it's emerged. But the point I want to make is that for the first 2 weeks when this broke out, the Obama administration's response was to call for calm and to call for an end to the cycle of violence. Now, what was going on were stabbing attacks. There is no more intimate form of terror than to stab an individual. It's not like going into a room and shooting it up. It's not like going into a concert hall. It's not like being a suicide bomber where who you're killing is all an abstraction to you. You go and you stab an individual, that's highly personal, and it's literally bloodletting. I said there's no more intimate form of terror than what was going on, stabbing. For 2 weeks, the administration didn't call it terror and referred to it as a cycle of violence. There actually wasn't a cycle of violence. There were acts of terror. Now, the inability for the first couple weeks to call it what it was and to single out Palestinians for criticism reflected both a habit of thinking and a mindset within the Obama administration. And the mindset was, well, you can't criticize only the Palestinians because it'll cause a backlash among Palestinians and among the Arabs. Now, the mindset is not unique to the Obama administration. The mindset I just described has existed in every administration from Truman to Obama. And it's been embodied in a constituency within the national security apparatus from Truman to Obama's time. That constituency looked at Israel as a problem and not a partner. Now, I set a context for you. I'm going to pose a question now. I just said in every administration from Truman to Obama, you've had in the national security apparatus a constituency that saw Israel as a problem and not a partner. In only one administration did that constituency have no influence. Okay, they existed in every administration But in only one did they have no influence. Which administration was that? Bush 43. Who said it, by the way? Who thought Bush 43? Several. I heard several people say it. Well, I just want to say it's a good guess. In fact, it's an excellent guess. It's wrong. But it's not Reagan. I'll give you the answer. But first, I want to see, when I pose the question, I want to elicit something from you, and then I'm going to respond to what you say. So the reason Bush 43 was an excellent guess, and in fact, not only the reason it was an excellent guess, do you realize that if President Obama were here and I posed that question, you know what he would say? He would have made the same guess. He would have said George W. Bush. And he would have said it because he had a perception of the Bush administration. In July of 2009, he met with a group of senior Jewish leaders, and one of them said to him in that meeting, you know, if you want Israel to move on peace, you have to be right next to them. And President Obama said in response, for 8 years, there was no daylight between the Bush administration and Israel did nothing, and it cost us with the Arabs. Okay, so the reason I say he would have guessed the same thing is because he felt there was no daylight for 8 years. And he said it led the Israelis to do nothing. Now, first, his history was not good because, in fact, we know the Israelis actually did some things. We know that Ariel Sharon withdrew all the settlements and all the IDF from Gaza. But there was no response when that was done. That was done precisely because he felt that he had the backing of the Bush administration and the president in particular. We know that in 2008, Ehud Olmert presented a proposal to cut through all the differences to Abu Mazen to solve the conflict. And that proposal went beyond the Clinton parameters to settle a conflict. I know something about the Clinton parameters because I drafted them. So Olmert actually went beyond the Clinton parameters, at least in terms of territory. Same thing, same reason, because he felt close. So the idea that, in fact, you know, there was a kind of, that the Israelis did nothing because of a closeness was wrong, because in fact they did something. The problem was there was no responsiveness to what they did. Now, what I just said to you sounds like I just confirmed the argument that the only administration where that constituency had no influence was Bush. Now, all I did is I proved that the Israelis actually did something. The fact is that there was daylight at certain points. The fact is that constituency had influence, and the best indication of it is President Bush, in his first call to Ariel Sharon after 9/11, after the president had declared a war on terror, in his first call to Ariel Sharon at that point, he was pressing him to have his then foreign minister, Shimon Peres, meet Yasser Arafat. At the time, we were in the midst of what was known as the Second Intifada, and bombs were going off in Israel. Now, George W. Bush would not have dreamed of having us talk to those responsible for 9/11. But he was pressing the Prime Minister of Israel to have his foreign minister meet with Yasser Arafat, who bore a direct responsibility at the time for the violence, for the acts of terror, for the bombings in Israel. The reason for it was because within the administration, the constituency I was describing convinced the president that 9/11 had taken place because we were too close to Israel, and that if we were going to have partners for the war on terror, which the president had declared, we needed to deal with the Palestinian problem. And we wouldn't have any partners for the war on terror unless we dealt with the Palestinian problem. So that constituency had weight. Now, President Bush evolves. You know, he himself writes that, you know, it didn't make sense that we'd have one set of rules for us when it came to the war on terror. We'd have a different set of rules for others, including the Israelis. Over time, he becomes a very strong friend, close friend to the Israelis, which helps to account for the 2005 withdrawal from Gaza and helps to account for the Olmert approach. But at the beginning, this constituency had the kind of weight that produced the call I just described. They reemerge again during the war that Israel has with Hezbollah in 2006. Their instincts are constantly tempered because in the end, Bush himself limits what they can do. All right, so Bush is not the answer. Good guess, but not the answer. So I heard several different guesses. I heard Reagan, which is not true. I heard somebody say Clinton. Who said Clinton? You're right. It was Bill Clinton. Now, it's just a coincidence that I was Clinton's negotiator. It is Bill Clinton, and not because, or at least not just because I was his negotiator. It was Bill Clinton for a reason. Clinton believed that we were Israel's only real friend in the world. We could have differences with Israel. That was okay. But we had to manage those differences. We had to keep the differences, in a sense, managed in private and not magnified in public. Because he believed that if we opened up a wedge between ourselves and Israel, that it would encourage Israel's enemies, it would weaken Israel's deterrent, it would make peace less likely. So it was Bill Clinton. That's the only administration where this constituency has no weight. Okay? So you like questions? You like the Q&A? At least you like my answers. You'll get questions later. Now it's my turn to ask the questions, okay? All right, I'm going to ask another question. All right, so which administration from Truman to Obama do you think was the toughest on Israel? Truman to Obama, which one? Carter is a good guess. Bush 41 is a good guess. But Eisenhower's right. Eisenhower's the answer. So you haven't even read the book, but you know. It is Eisenhower. It's Eisenhower, and it's Eisenhower for a reason. Eisenhower looks at the Truman decision to recognize the state of Israel as being done only for political reasons. And he looks at it that way for a simple reason. Every single one of the president's national security advisors, cabinet officials, military, security, secretary of state, intelligence, every single one of them were against the recognition of the state, every single one. In fact, there was a book that was written once that was entitled The Wise Men. So it meant George C. Marshall, Forrestal, George Kennan, Robert Lovett. All the wise men were against the recognition of the state of Israel. They all thought it would be disaster for us. The only person who is pushing Truman to recognize is Clark Clifford. And Clark Clifford is actually a domestic political counselor at the time. I'm not going to go through a particular meeting. Oh, hell, I will go through the meeting. I'll get back to Eisenhower in a second, but I want to explain what happened with Truman. Because it helps to explain Eisenhower. May 12th, 3 days before the end of the British mandate, the British are going to pull out midnight, 12:01, May 15th, 1948. And the president hosts a meeting on May 12th to determine what we should do right after that happens, because there's an assumption, correctly, that the Jews will declare themselves a state. So Marshall comes over, brings Lovett, who's the undersecretary, sees Truman, and Clark Clifford is with Truman. Clifford's a domestic political counselor. And first thing that Marshall says when he walks in and he sees Clark Clifford, he says, "What's he doing here? This is a foreign policy, national security meeting. This isn't about domestic politics." And Truman says, "Well, I asked him." So Marshall proceeds to explain why we should not recognize the state, and that we should preserve a trusteeship, a UN trusteeship, after the British leave. Lovett, after Marshall speaks and explains why it's in our interest to have a trusteeship, Lovett says, and the reason we don't want to do it also is because the Jewish state will be basically an outpost for the Soviets. I'm not making this up, you know. You got to actually read this, and you'll see. I mean, I actually read the memcon of the meeting. So, and it's in the Truman Tractor. Truman turns to Clifford. And Clifford proceeds to outline a series of arguments. Now, the fact is, the only one to write a series of serious analytical pieces explaining why we should be supporting the Jewish state in March of 48 and then just before this meeting is Clark Clifford, the domestic policy counselor, not a national security guy. And Clifford proceeds to say, first, the Jews, notwithstanding the fact that they've got no help from us, have belied all of the predictions of our intelligence experts. The CIA, the day before the partition vote at the UN, had issued an intelligence assessment in which it said, no way can the Jews last, no way can they survive. The only way a Jewish state is possible is if you send 500,000 American troops there to install them. Otherwise, they can't survive. And Clifford says, all the intelligence people said they couldn't survive. We imposed an arms embargo, which is true. We have the partition plan is on November 29, 1947. December 5th, 1947, we impose an arms embargo. It penalizes only one side, meaning it penalizes the Jews, because the British are providing arms to Egypt. The British are providing arms to the Arab Legion. The Arab Legion is the Transjordan's military, and those who lead the Transjordanian military are seconded British officers. So their arms, their money, and their officers are basically British. And the British are also providing arms to the Hashemite Kingdom in Iraq at the time. So our imposing the arms embargo means only the Jews don't get arms. And so Clifford points out, notwithstanding the predictions, notwithstanding the fact that they got no help from us, they've made themselves a state. If you don't recognize them, you're penalizing them. Why would we penalize them for their success when they've succeeded against all the odds and all the predictions here? That's his first point. And he says, by the way, he says, and it will damage your credibility, Mr. President, because you supported the partition plan, and now, after they've succeeded on the ground, then you're going to penalize them? His second argument is to say we shouldn't be giving in to threats, because the Arab states were saying they'll invade after this. And he said, we shouldn't be intimidated by the threats. How will we be seen as being credible if we're intimidated by threats? And the third thing he says, and by the way, he says we shouldn't quake. The actual quote was, you know, we shouldn't appease, these Arab threats. No one will take us seriously if we appease these threats. You think we're going to be respected internationally if we do this? And he says that as second point. His third point, he says, look, the idea that we're going to lose Arab oil, that's absurd. The Arabs can't drink their oil. At this point, Marshall has been getting more and more agitated as Clifford is speaking. And he finally blurts out and he says, you know, these are only political arguments. I don't know about you, but I didn't hear a political argument in there. He says, these are only political arguments. And he says, if I were to vote, now you understand George C. Marshall was Secretary of State, but he was our country's only five-star general. So, you know, as a five-star general and military guy, he hadn't voted. So he says, if I were to vote, and if you were to follow Clifford's advice, I wouldn't vote for you. That's a pretty amazing thing to have happened, right? So just like in here, there was silence. In that room, there was silence. There was a kind of long, pregnant pause. And Truman then says, well, I'm inclined to agree with you, General. And the meeting ends. But Lovett, the undersecretary, is disturbed because he realizes a breach has just been opened between the president and secretary of state. That night, he goes to see Clifford in his apartment, and he works out with Clifford an understanding that it's okay for us to recognize after they declare themselves a state. We won't recognize before. Now, Eisenhower looks at this history and he thinks, how could Truman have possibly recognized a state given the fact that all the experts, all the senior advisors, all the national security people were against it? And he resolves that when he becomes president, he's going to bring our politics and our policy towards the Middle East back into balance. he and Dulles, the Secretary of State, both believe that the Middle East is the most important region in the world, and our interests lie with the Arabs. And we're going to pursue our interests. One of the first things he does when he comes in, the Israelis begin to try to use Jordan River water to generate hydroelectric power. The Arabs complain about it, and so he cuts off the loans that had been provided by Truman. He suspends them as a penalty on the Israelis. In the 1956 war, the Israelis go into the Sinai. They do it in coordination and collusion with the British and the French, who were responding to Nasser, who nationalized the Suez Canal. And Eisenhower drafts a Security Council resolution. I mean, the administration drafts a Security Council resolution not only to condemn the Israelis, but to insist that they stop, that all countries should cut off contacts, any assistance to Israel, until they withdraw. The British and the French actually veto that resolution. It is the last time they vetoed a resolution towards Israel, but that protects Israel, but they veto the resolution. Eisenhower goes, instructs that we go to the UN General Assembly. He makes it clear that we will impose sanctions on Israel unless they withdraw. His Undersecretary of State, Herbert Hoover Jr., calls in the then Israeli ambassador to the United States, Abba Ibn, and tells him if the Israelis don't withdraw, we will push to expel them from the UN. Pretty tough stuff. The reason it's Herbert Hoover Jr. and not Dulles, third day of the war, Dulles suffers an acute abdominal attack, which actually turns out to be cancer, which eventually kills him. Otherwise, he would have been the one threatening expulsion. It is true that during the life of the Eisenhower administration, Eisenhower never suspends weapons to Israel. But that's because he never provides weapons to Israel. Every time the Israelis come in and make a weapons request, in response to the fact that starting in 1955, the Soviets begin to provide arms, massive amounts of arms, to Egypt and then Syria, and starting in 1958, after the coup in Iraq, to Iraq as well, even though there are massive Soviet arms going into the region against those who are all threatening Israel, we turn down every Israeli request, and in fact, we tell the Israelis, the Eisenhower administration tells the Israelis, you should seek the goodwill of your neighbors. Now, every one of their neighbors rejected their existence. So seeking the goodwill of their neighbors, even if they sought it, wasn't a very easy thing to do. So Eisenhower is the toughest. There's no question. By the way, I didn't even go through all the things that Eisenhower did. I just gave you some of the highlights. But it's true. Eisenhower is the toughest. Now, I said he never suspended weapons because he never provided weapons. Which administration... There's one administration that suspended weapons to Israel as a punishment. Not Carter. No, he never suspended weapons. He never did. That's not true. That's absolutely not true. In fact, he did provide the missiles. What's that? No, not Nixon. Nixon did suspend weapons. I'll get to that in a minute. But he didn't do it as a penalty. I'm talking about which American president suspended weapons to Israel as a punishment. Only one did. Reagan. Who said Reagan? You're right. It's Reagan. It's Reagan. It's Reagan who suspends F-16s to Israel after Israel bombs the Osirik nuclear reactor in Iraq in May of 1981. In the fall of 1981, after he has ended the suspension, he ends the suspension, and then in December of 1981, he suspends them again. You know why? I can see you thinking really hard.
I was there at the time.
Yeah, December 1981. Why would he have suspended F-16s a second time?
Lebanon.
And now it's not Lebanon. We'll get back to Lebanon. It's because he extends Israel. Menachem Begin extends Israel's law and administration to the Golan Heights, meaning it looks like he annexes the Golan Heights. And Reagan believes that's a violation of Security Council Resolution 242, so he suspends F-16s a second time. But that is not the low point of the Reagan administration. The low point of the Reagan administration comes during the summer of 1982 with the siege of Beirut. The siege of Beirut goes on from basically June 11th, when Israel reaches the outskirts of Beirut, until Arafat withdraws from Beirut on September 1. The whole summer is a siege of Beirut. Israel's bombing. They're trying to force Arafat out. We sent Phil Habib over there. On multiple occasions, Reagan actually threatens the future of the relationship. The low, low point is after Arafat gets out, and then you have Saban Shatila. This is the Falange militia after Bashar Gemayel, who was their leader, is assassinated. They decide to wreak revenge against the Palestinians, even though it was probably the Syrians who were responsible for the assassination. They go into Saban Shatila. The reason this is a scandal is because the IDF is surrounding these camps. They allow them in. This produces a huge backlash, by the way, within Israel. Eventually leads to the Cain Commission, which ultimately leads to Sharon having to resign as defense minister. But that's really the low point in the relationship during Reagan. And yet, if I said to you, I've just described what obviously were very tough postures in the Reagan administration towards Israel. If I ask this audience, do you think Reagan is remembered as being anti-Israel or pro-Israel? Right. You would all say pro. And you know what? You'd all be right. So how do I square what I just said with that answer? Well, because in January of 1984, Reagan transforms the relationship. In January 1984, he creates, under his auspices, he creates something called the Joint Political Military Group. For the first time in our history, Reagan creates a security structure for strategic cooperation and strategic partnership with Israel. It is an architecture that is built on by every succeeding president. It is an architecture that creates cooperation military service to military service, Defense Department to Ministry of Defense in Israel, intelligence community to intelligence community, even economically. Reagan in January 84 does that after the low point in the fall of 1982. What happened in between? What could have triggered that? 1983, bombing of our embassy in Beirut in April of 83, October of 83, bombing of the Marine barracks. We lose 241 Marines. And Reagan goes back to his roots. He goes back to his instincts. He has within his administration those who want to be very tough on the Israelis. During the summer of 82, his defense secretary wants to break relations with Israel. You know, normally something that's reserved for countries like North Korea. Now, Reagan doesn't do that. With the bombing of our embassy and then the bombing of the Marine barracks, Reagan sees who's the real threat to us. You know, the Syrians have been defeated by the Israelis during the summer of 82. They're ready to get out. If the Israelis will get out in the fall of 82, the Soviets rebuild them. They bring in SAM-5 missiles, long-range surface-to-air missiles. They rebuild them. Hezbollah is established by the Revolutionary Guard in Lebanon. Hezbollah is responsible probably for the bombings of both the embassy and the Marine barracks. The Soviets are seen as building up this threat. These different militias frustrate what we're trying to do in Lebanon and threaten our forces. And Reagan goes back to his roots. Reagan goes back to his instincts. Reagan, during World War II, did training films. And in that capacity, he was among the first to see the films of the liberation of the death camps. And it profoundly affects Reagan. One other American president is profoundly affected by this, Lyndon Johnson. Lyndon Johnson goes, yes, Eisenhower, it's true. Eisenhower wanted everyone to see what was there, but it doesn't affect his view. It doesn't create a sense for him that somehow we have a moral obligation to the Jews and Israel. With Reagan, it creates a sense that we do have a moral obligation. He believes we have a moral obligation to Israel. In the first 2 years of the administration, the Israelis took a number of actions that surprised us and he felt cost us. And those who were around him felt it cost us, Weinberger and to some extent Vice President Bush. But when he goes back to his roots, when he goes back to his instincts, he does it in a significant way. What's interesting, I'll just note also parenthetically, the first year is also marked by Israeli opposition to his decision to sell AWACS to the Saudis. Reagan says on October 1, 1981, he holds a press conference, at a time when the intense campaign in the Senate to determine whether or not the sale is going to succeed or not succeed, He gives a press conference where he says it's not the business of a foreign country to determine American foreign policy. That's a quote. You know, had I started this off by saying which president said that, I can guess you would have guessed many other presidents. Probably not Reagan, but Reagan says that. That's about as tough a dual loyalty thing as any president has ever said. In fact, no other president says anything like that. But Reagan isn't remembered for that. Reagan isn't stigmatized by that because Reagan transforms the relationship. He builds a strategic partnership with Israel. He approaches Israel differently from 1984 on. And there's one other big thing that happens during the Reagan administration. Prior to Reagan, the only constituency in the national security apparatus that exists is the constituency that sees Israel as a problem. You have individuals who see things differently. You have a Clark Clifford during Truman's time. You don't have anybody in Eisenhower. But you have a Kissinger during Nixon. But he's an individual. There isn't a constituency that backs him. In Reagan's time, there's a countervailing constituency that emerges. And that countervailing constituency sees Israel as a partner, not as a problem. Every president, every administration since Reagan's time has had within the bureaucracy these two competing kinds of groups. And depending upon the orientation of the president, what you see is which way that administration tends to tilt. But there's now a battle. I mean, there's now a struggle in terms of shaping the policy. The interesting thing is from Reagan's time on, every single succeeding president, even if they don't have an emotional attachment to Israel, they build on that security cooperation, the structure of security cooperation. Every president, including Obama. In many ways, Obama has done more than any of his predecessors in the security area. Now, the reason that hasn't taken root in perceptions is because his approach towards the Palestinians has been to look at the Palestinians as being weak, Israel as being strong, therefore the onus is on Israel. But when it comes to the security relationship and the character of it, he has done more than any of his predecessors, following in the tradition that every president since Reagan's time has built on the structure that Reagan created. All right, so what I want to describe in the time I have left before we turn to your questions are three assumptions that have been embedded in every administration from Truman until Obama, and I'll bring it up to today. Three assumptions that are interrelated. The first one is that if you distance from Israel, you'll gain with the Arabs. Five administrations do that. Eisenhower does it. Nixon does it. Carter does it. Bush does it. And Obama does it. I described Obama doing it, you know, when he described there was no daylight. Well, he, in the first 6 months, he created daylight. He created daylight by the way he approached the settlement issue. He was conscious. When you read the Obama chapter, you'll see. It's very consciously done to create a sense of distance. He visits Turkey, Saudi Arabia, and Egypt, but he doesn't go to Israel. He gives a speech in Cairo that addresses the Arab narrative, the Palestinian narrative, but not the Israeli narrative, and he doesn't go to Israel afterwards. And you'll see this is done consciously because there's an expectation it's going to produce a response from the Arabs. It does not. In fact, in the five different administrations at distance, they never gain anything. The most egregious example of doing this, of distancing and not gaining, is not Obama. It's Nixon. You know, Nixon did suspend F-4 Phantoms to Israel. But he didn't do it as a penalty. He was doing it as an inducement. He was trying to reach out to Nasser. What makes it egregious is that the moment that he did this was the moment that the Soviets, for the first time in their history, were sending their military personnel outside of the Soviet bloc. At this time, 10,000 Soviet military personnel leave the Warsaw Pact area and go to Egypt to take over Egypt's air defense. The very moment they're doing it, this is the moment that Nixon chooses to suspend F-4s to the Israelis. And he sends his Undersecretary of State, Joe Sisko, there to say to Nasser, look at the gesture we've just taken. You know, to prove our goodwill towards you, we've suspended F-4s to the Israelis. And that's his response. He demands more. He does the equivalent of, say, diplomatically, he just blows him off. Right? Every time we try to distance, and this is what I highlight in every chapter, and when you'll see it in those administrations that do it, every time we distance, we don't gain anything. What we do is we increase the demands, but we don't gain a responsiveness. All right, so there's a corollary to that assumption. The corollary to that assumption is, okay, so if you cooperate with Israel, you'll lose with the Arabs. So the best example of this, although, again, I can go through and show many, the best example is actually Kennedy. Kennedy is the first president to make a decision to provide arms to Israel. We don't provide arms to Israel. We don't provide a weapon system to Israel until John Kennedy. And he makes a decision to provide Israel Hawk anti-aircraft missiles. The Hawk anti-aircraft missile that he provides is not mobile. It's a fixed site, meaning it can only be used for defensive purposes. It can only be used against attacking aircraft. Now, before the decision is finalized, this triggers an enormous controversy and debate within the administration. The cables that come in from our ambassadors overseas basically say that it'll be the end of our relationship in the Middle East if we provide these arms to Israel. Dean Rusk, the Secretary of State, says if we do this, it'll set a terrible precedent and it will cause grave damage. I'm quoting, grave damage to our relations with the Arabs. Now, as luck would have it, for us, the same day the news of this comes out is the day that he's meeting the real leader of Saudi Arabia in New York for the opening of the UN General Assembly. And that's Crown Prince Faisal. So, you know, here's the guy who's predicted grave damage to the relationship. So what does he find when he goes in there? Does he hear from Crown Prince Faisal, the diplomatic equivalent of, you're dead to me? Does he hear him say, you're providing arms to them, that's it, forget it, we want nothing to do with you? Is that what he gets from Crown Prince Faisal? What do you think? Is that what he gets? Right answer. It's a rhetorical question. Okay, what does he get? What he gets is Crown Prince Faisal doesn't even raise the issue. What does he raise? He raises the coup in Yemen that has been backed by Nasser. He says Nasser's trying to gain a foothold in the Arabian Peninsula to threaten Saudi Arabia. And what does he ask for? He asks for American arms and American assurances. Not only does he not raise the issue of Israeli arms, he asks for American arms in response to what he perceives to be a threat. Okay, a week goes by, he goes down to Washington, he sees John Kennedy. So maybe in that intervening week, he's come to his senses. Maybe he realizes he should have been complaining about the Israeli arms. Maybe he realizes, oh my God, I missed this opportunity. I have to tell the president what a mistake it was to do this. Is that what he does? Pregnant pause. Is that what he does? No, you're right. That's not what he does. When he sees President Kennedy, he goes, and again, he doesn't raise this issue. What does he raise? He raises with President Kennedy the mistake that President Kennedy, according to him, has made is he's reached out to Nasser. Our outreach to Nasser is a big mistake. He tells President Kennedy, you are providing economic assistance to Nasser. The provision of economic assistance to Nasser is freeing up his resources to threaten us and to threaten all your friends and to change the balance of power in the region. At this point, Kennedy, when he came in, provided PL 480 funds to Egypt. These are funds we use to basically pay for excess wheat that we produce to give to countries. At this point, two-thirds of Egypt's bread supply was coming from us. And Crown Prince Faisal, who's the real leader of Saudi Arabia at the time, Crown Prince Faisal is saying it's your outreach, it's your resources, it's your giving him this economic assistance that is freeing up resources for him to cause trouble in the rest of the region and to threaten your friends and to change the balance of power. Now, does that sound familiar to you? Does that sound like something you maybe have heard recently? Does it sound like something that is being said in the region today? If you substitute the word Iran for Egypt, is this not exactly what Saudi Arabia has been saying for the last few years? This is a rhetorical question. What does it reveal? What does it reflect? It reflects that things don't change, but it reflects something else. Where did I start? I started with us not getting what are the priorities of the Sunnis today. The reason they're not joining us is because, when it comes to fighting ISIS, is because their priority is Iran. We don't get things right if we don't understand what their priorities are. If you look at the examples I've given, both past and now present, what you see is what matters to Arab leaders is their security and their survival. That's their main priority. And who do they see threatens their security and their survival? Always their regional rivals. In the 50s and 60s, it was Nasser. Then it was Gaddafi. Then it was Saddam Hussein. Now it's Iran. Their priority is who threatens them. Their priority is they need American support and reliability as it relates to their security and their survival. They never made their relationship with us dependent on our relationship with Israel. Why? First, they didn't see Israel as a threat. Secondly, because what mattered to them was security guarantees and assurances from us. It didn't mean that they liked the Israelis. It didn't mean that they loved the idea of the relationship. But they were never going to let that affect what was most important to them. We will not get foreign policy right in the Middle East until we understand what their priorities are. I said at the outset, you don't have to accept their priorities, but you have to understand them. And you have to shape policies in light of that. All right, I said there was three assumptions. There's a third assumption. The third assumption was you cannot fix the American position in the Middle East, and you cannot transform the Middle East itself unless you solve the Palestinian issue. That assumption has existed in every administration. Now, obviously, it's just as flawed as the other ones. Tomorrow, if we solve the Palestinian issue, would it stop one barrel bomb in Syria? Would it roll back ISIS 1 meter? Would it end the war in Yemen? Would it change the existential struggle that President Sisi is facing with radical Islamists in Egypt? Would it make Libya whole? The answer is no to all of those. It is not a game changer in the region. That should be clearer now than ever before. Now, it might strike some of you as interesting that I'm the one saying this, because I spent the last 30 years of my life trying to solve the Israeli-Palestinian issue. And I'm still trying to deal with it today, but not because it's a game changer in the region. It's important in its own right. If you're a supporter of Israel and you don't want Israel to become a binational state, then you better figure out a way to deal with the Palestinians. Producing an outcome, if you can, is in Israel's interest and it's in America's interest. This is an intractable conflict. Settling an intractable conflict, if you can, is useful psychologically, but not because it changes the Middle East. Do it for the right reasons. Don't do it because, once again, you don't understand the region. I'm still committed to trying to do something, although I know today peace is not necessarily something that is possible. But I also know that if Israel stays on exactly the track it's on, it runs the risk of becoming a binational state. So you have to have an approach to that. And if you ask me in the Q&A, I'll address what I would do about it. But so why, as I wrap up, so why did I title the book Doomed to Succeed? Yeah, it's a clever title, but why did I entitle it Doomed to Succeed? First, because this is a relationship that by now you should get a sense, it has evolved. It started off, for the first 20 years of Israel's existence, we are not the main provider of arms to Israel, and we're not the most important economic supporter of Israel. This is a relationship that evolved over time. It's had ups and downs over time. There have been differences between presidents and prime ministers over time. It's not unique to this president and this prime minister. But it has evolved in a way and has had a certain trajectory for a number of reasons. We in Israel, the United States and Israel, share values. We share interests. The same forces that threaten Israel almost always threaten us. The same forces that threaten us almost always threaten Israel. The reason we've seen a certain trajectory is because Israel is the only democracy in the Middle East. You were talking at the outset in talking about the sort of the new anti, I will call it the new anti-Semitism, because that's what it is. The effort to delegitimize Israel is a new anti-Semitism, because it's not a criticism of Israeli policies, it's a criticism of Israel's existence. It's a criticism of anybody who supports its existence. That's why it's the new anti-Semitism. Look at this region. This is a region that is characterized by a threat to the state system, two proxy wars, a fundamental struggle over who's going to define identity. You want to know why the violence in the Middle East is so terrible today? Because it's over something as basic as identity and who owns it, who defines it, who shapes it. Increasingly, you see the threats and the sense of coalescence around smaller and smaller kinds of units, sect, tribe, clan. You fight for survival, the violence is terrible. This is a region that is involved in a struggle over identity, and it's going to take more than a decade to sort it out. Now think about it, against that backdrop, against the backdrop of a region that's going to be characterized by conflict, unpredictability, instability, uncertainty, there is one country in the region that actually is governed by a rule of law. There's one country in the region that has an independent judiciary. There's one country in the region that has freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, freedom of the press, artistic freedom, regularly and unregularly scheduled elections. Where the loser accepts the outcome, the hallmark of democracy. One country in the region where women's rights are respected. One country in the region where gay rights are respected. One country in the region where it's safe to be gay. Where do Palestinian gays go? They go to Tel Aviv. No, they go to Tel Aviv. They go to Tel Aviv. The point is, Israel has its own set of problems. They're not small, but Israel has a set of institutions, and it has the capacity to deal with its problems. Israel will have a basic orientation. Israel is the one country in the region that we actually can count on, and it's because of that and because of who Israel is that I entitled the book Doomed to Succeed. I'll stop there.
You've been listening to a lecture program from the University of Nebraska at Omaha on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Dennis Ross, the William Davidson Distinguished Fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, and a Distinguished Professor of Diplomacy at Georgetown University's Walsh School of Foreign Service. He is the author of Doomed to Succeed, the U.S.-Israel Relationship from Truman to Obama, which was also the topic of his presentation. His remarks were given as the annual Ruth and Phil Sokoloff Lecture. This program, co-sponsored by the Natan and Hannah Schwalb Center for Israel and Jewish Studies at the University of Nebraska at Omaha, was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, April 5th, 2016, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Casey Davis, staff assistant with the Schwalb Center for Israel and Jewish Studies, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 600 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.